Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday morning here on GCN, we strive to expose the deadly and the destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, even with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while keeping an eye on how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then during our second hour, we will engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant and through His always dependable Torah teaching. Our phone number, if you'd like to engage in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. Our first item in the news, something we hinted at briefly yesterday. This is from CNN. Hezbollah has threatened to intervene further in Syria if there is any threat the regime could fall to the United States, Israel, or extremists, the Lebanese militant group said. It is hilarious in a way. Well, first, back which were peaceful protests against Assad, who in the Assad family would be ranked up there right among the most ruthless dictators in the world. Back in the day, Assad's father didn't like what people in a particularly Sunni community were saying about him, and to show them that they ought not open their yaps and express their opinions, he surrounded the city with tanks, and then sent in artillery, then firebombed it, and then bulldozed it, burying alive and dead some 30 to 40,000 of its citizens. And yet the United States thought that we ought to invade Iraq instead of Syria. Not that invading Syria would have been smart, but when you can't make the connection, that's pretty sad. Now, he can't be the worst dictator of the modern era, because the fundamentalist Islamic government in the Sudan has led a genocide over the last 25 years that has killed 3 million people. And so they would rank up there as the most ruthless regime. But nonetheless, the Assad regime has been repulsive in typical Islamic fashion. But for Hezbollah to say that it would intervene if Syria would fall to the United States, Israel, or extremists is hilarious. The United States might be prodded by the likes of I Never Met a War I Didn't Like, John McCain, or by the I Want to Be the Messiah of the World, and Islam is the world's greatest religion, Obama. It might well be prodded by them to engage U.S. assets more aggressively on the greater of two evils sides in Syria. But there is a 0% chance that Syria is going to fall to the United States. Even if the United States were stupid enough, which it isn't, I mean, we didn't learn a lesson from Vietnam. We did not learn a lesson from Afghanistan. We did not learn a lesson from Iraq. And we are still capable of making stupid decisions like invading countries, making bad situations worse. But right on the heels of having lost $6 trillion in our ill-fated invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States is not in a position where it can invade Syria. Not going to happen. And as for Israel, Israel has a zero interest in invading Syria. The last thing that the Israelis want is to have to be responsible for 20 million Muslims. They'd like to get rid of the 3 million Muslims they currently have living inside of Israel. They don't want responsibility for more of them. That isn't going to happen. And, of course, Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, knows the United States is not going to invade Syria, and he knows that Israel isn't going to invade Syria, and that neither country has any interest of doing so. As for extremists, that's funny. Hezbollah is an Islamic terrorist organization. Their views on Islam are fundamentalist. Those who are opposing them are Sunni terrorist organizations. Their views on Islam are fundamentalist. The only difference is between the two of them is that one is Sunni, the other is Shia. And there really isn't much difference when you get down to it between Sunni and Shia. It's kind of like comparing the Greek Orthodox Church with the Roman Catholic Church. Same doctrine. You know, it goes right back to the same guy, Constantine. Same playbook written by Paul. Same caricature of God. All the way through, the same exact source material. The only difference is who's in charge. In the case of Shia and Sunni Islam, that's the only difference. Same Muhammad, same Hadith, same Quran, same religion. It's just who's in charge. That would be the only difference between the Sunni terrorists, who the United States and Europe is aiding and abetting in the Syrian war, and Hezbollah. But I have said for now 2 years that while there is no way to win, there's no way to pick a good side, even the lesser of two evils in Syria. The lesser of two evils doesn't exist in Syria. That conflict, which has now claimed over 100,000 lives and probably twice that number in terms of people unaccounted for, and the rape of five or six times that many women, is just starting. It's just at its infancy, should Hezbollah engage. And Hezbollah has been involved in some minor skirmishes, but Hezbollah is the best equipped Islamic terrorist organization in the world. It's the best run, best equipped, most disciplined Islamic terrorist organization in the world. They, you know, Al-Qaeda was always more of a phantom. You know, the Taliban is a large and very well-equipped, very well-run Islamic terrorist organization, but they're nothing compared to Hezbollah. Should they get involved in a major way in Syria, the carnage would be incomprehensible. This article says the radical Shiite group, they're not radical, they're fundamentalists, which the United States and Israel call a terrorist organization. Yeah, they use terrorist tactics. That's not their primary tactic, however. Hezbollah's primary tactic is guerrilla warfare. Their primary enemy is the Israeli government and Israeli military and Israeli police. They have said that they are in Syria to protect the country and to protect their holy Shiite shrines from warfare. But reports emerged months ago that Hezbollah fighters are battling in Syria, the Syrian rebels near the Lebanese border. And I've shared those reports with you. On Tuesday, Hezbollah means Allah's party, leader Hassan Nasrallah, said that the group could step up its presence in Syria and issued an ominous warning to opposition members backed by foreigners who may try to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad's regime. This is his quote. Syria has real friends in the region and in the world. That is true. Syria's friends in the region and the world are, number one, Iran, because Iran and Hezbollah are one and the same. Number two is Iraq, because the United States gave Iraq to Iran. And the enormous amount of support is being supplied by Iraq to the Assad regime, courtesy of the United States. Number three is Russia, because of the deal that exists between the Russians and the Iranians vis-a-vis both terrorism in Russia, particularly in the Caucasus region, in Chechistan, but also because of their joint interest in the oil in the Caspian Sea area. And the third, also because of the oil in the Caspian Sea area, China. Those are Hezbollah's and Syria's, the Assad regime's, friends. And they are powerful. So he is correct in saying that Syria has by real friends. These are not friends in the sense of real friends, but they are allies in the world. And they will never allow Syria to fall into the hands of the United States, Israel, or extremist groups. Well, it's true that China and Russia and Iran would not allow either United States or Israel to occupy Syria. There is no chance that either has an interest in doing so. But by targeting a false enemy, creating a straw man, Nasrallah's comments, which are designed to be heard by unthinking individuals, he's effective. But it is a straw man. They would never allow it. You may ask, how will this happen? The details will come later, Nasrallah said. That's obvious that the moment the United States or Europe, Saudi Arabia or Qatar, on one side decide that they wish to take a more active role, and rather than working to supply weapons to the Sunni terrorists in Syria, and overtly decide that they're going to deploy their own military resources, then you will see major responses from China and Russia, and it will boil over into a world war. That's the reality of the situation. That's why the Syrian situation is so incredibly frightening. The two-year-old civil war, this article reads, has been fueled not only by demands for more freedom and an end to Assad's family dynasty, but also by sectarian strife. That really is untrue. This war has been fueled exclusively as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Qatar on one side, the Sunnis that don't like the idea that they've lost influence in the region to Iran as a result of America's invasion of Iraq, and they don't like it. The egos in the Islamic world are enormous, and purposefully, deliberately, armed and equipped this war. This war began because of the awakening councils that the United States established, and a peaceful protest turned to an armed conflict because of those reasons, and had nothing to do with Assad, his dynasty, or more freedom. As a matter of fact, if the Sunni rebels who were opposing the Assad regime prevail, there will be infinitely less freedom in Syria than there was before, or even is now. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is a conclusion to the last story. I can tell you with grave concern that if my prediction holds true, that ultimately the weaponizing of the Syrian conflict by Iraq, by Iran, by Qatar, by Saudi Arabia, by the United States, and by Europe, if it continues to be a jihadist paradise for Mujahideen, to the point that the Assad regime is ultimately threatened, and Hezbollah engages on behalf of the Assad regime, the consequences will elevate the carnage in that war many times. And the world will find itself on a precipice of a world war, because the world has taken sides with China and Russia on the side of Iran and thus Assad, and the United States and Europe on the opposing side. It is a very frightening situation. We have a first-time listener that has called in and wants to speak about the self-proclaimed Apostle Paul. His name is Paul. He's calling in from Ontario, Canada. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Oh, very good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, I just started to listen to you, and, you know, I'm really, that's really, really something new to me. So of course I'm as far as the Torah is concerned, or God's word, or Yahweh word, I'm for it.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you 100%. But now, what do we do with, you know, Apostle Paul, for example, Book of Acts, written by Luke? It's a continuation of Gospel of Luke, and you know, almost the whole chapter or the whole book is, like, you know, about Paul.
He's correct.
His conversion, and then correct. through the ages, many evangelists, many Christians, many generations of Christians, they used his teaching, they used his his words to convert or to witness, convert other people. What do we do with those things? Mm-hmm. Right? Can you give me like a few words?
Sure, absolutely. First of all, your opening comments are extremely astute. You know and used God's name. His name is Yahweh. There is no way to know God unless you know his name. His name is so essential to knowing who he is and what he is offering us. Without knowing his name, you can't know him. The second thing that you said that was extremely astute is that you're all for the Torah. Christians almost universally are opposed to the Torah because of Paul. And yet the Torah is God's foundation. It's the only place that God can be known. Apart from the Torah, God cannot be known. Apart from the Torah, the covenant, which is God's entire purpose for creating the universe and conceiving life, the covenant, its terms and conditions, its benefits are only presented in one place, the Torah. And God's plan of salvation, which is a byproduct of the covenant, which includes 7 days that we meet with God each year, where each of those 7 days has a specific purpose in God's overall plan relative to our salvation, that plan is only presented in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So to anyone who discounts the Torah is discounting God.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who discounts the Torah doesn't know God. Anyone who discounts the Torah has no relationship with God, because that's only possible through the covenant. And anyone who discounts the Torah can't be saved, because the path to salvation is delineated in those 7 days as they are presented in the Torah. So your opening statement, Paul, was brilliant. Are you familiar with Paulus was Paul's assumed name? He chose the name. It's a Latin name. It means lowly and small.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with what Paul's given name was? The name that he was born with?
Shaul.
Shaul, correct. You know what Shaul means?
I forgot now, but I've read it somewhere. But
By the way, I hope you have some time to stay with me, because I would love to have this discussion with you, because I don't think there's any discussion more important than this in terms of awakening people. There's nothing that's more important than people coming to recognize the topic we're discussing at the moment. His given name is Shaul. It means question him.
What question? Oh.
Question him. Let me read you something that Yahweh wrote about Shaul, calling him by name in a book called Habakkuk. Okay? Habakkuk means embrace this. Yahweh begins by reinforcing the fact that his requirements and his responsibilities, as they're outlined in the Torah, he says, upon my requirements and my responsibilities, I have decided that I will continually stand. In other words, God is saying, I'm not going to change. I've laid out my plan. I'm going to do what I promised to do. And if there are requirements in my plans for you to engage in a relationship with me, I'm not changing it. So, upon my requirements and responsibilities, I have decided I will continually stand. I will choose to stand up, providing affirmation and validation for that which protects and fortifies. So I will be on the lookout to see what he, speaking of Shaul, who I'll name in a moment, will say about me, observing how he will question me. We'll return to this, and Paul, please stay. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. I'm on the phone here with Paul, who is a first-time listener. He's called in from Canada on one of the most important topics that I think that we can devote our attention to. Paul correctly said that I'm all for Yahweh, all for his Torah. But what do we do with, for example, the book of Acts, which is a continuation of Luke's hearsay account? He didn't use the term hearsay, but Luke was not an eyewitness, so it is a hearsay account. What do we do with the book of Acts, which is devoted mostly to Paul and considering all of the things that have been done in Paul's name? And so, Paul, what I wanted to do, and I'm I know we have two Pauls we're talking about here. Shaul, who chose the name Paulos, and my new best friend here in Ontario, Canada, named Paul. And what I wanted to do here, Paul, since you said you could stay with us a bit, is I did not want to give you my opinion. My conclusion is what you should do with the three quarters of the books of Acts and all of Paul's letters. I wanted to give you Yahweh's opinion, because Yahweh's opinion is irrefutable and it matters. Mine doesn't. So since Yahweh gave us his opinion on what we should do with the three quarters of the book of Acts and all of Paul's letters, I wanted to discuss that with you, if I may. So let me begin where he began again, and I'm adding my commentary on this because sometimes it's helpful for people to make a connection and you may know Yahweh very well, and you may be able to make all of these connections. Many of our listeners may not be able to, so I'm going to try to make the connections so that people understand what God is talking about here. So he says, upon my requirements and my responsibilities, there are five requirements to participate in the covenant, and God has the responsibility of enabling the covenant's benefits, of which there are five. The benefits of the covenant are: we become immortal, we become perfect, we are adopted into God's family, we are enriched with his teaching and his presence, and we are empowered by his Spirit. And the requirements to participate in the covenant are that we must walk away from Babylon. We must walk away from our country, from politics and religion. God will not have that stuff in his home. Second, that rather than relying on politics and religion, we turn to Yahweh, we come to know him, and we trust and rely on him instead. The third requirement is that we walk to God and become perfect. We do that through the Moed Mikre, which are the seven steps that God has provided. That's the responsibility that he has to enable that path to his home. The first four of which he fulfilled in years 4000 Yah, which is 33 CE. The fourth is to observe, to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions associated with the covenant, because that's the single most important thing in the Torah. And the fifth, to show that we are committed to raising our children so they will become God's children. We're asked to circumcise our sons. Those are the five requirements. Those are the responsibilities of Yahweh, are outlined in the seven steps that we walk to God, beginning with the doorway of Passover, and then through unyeasted bread to Bukurim, which is firstborn child, and Shavuah are the first four steps, seven Sabbaths, of which Yahusha fulfilled those Moed Mikre in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. So God is saying, upon my requirements and my responsibilities, I have decided to continually stand. So God's saying, there's going to be somebody coming in the future that's going to tell you that I've changed my mind and I've come up with an entirely different plan that's completely apart from the Torah's presentation, and I'm going to go to a different plan. God is saying, don't buy that. I'm not changing. He says, I will choose to stand up, which he did. He stood up for us so we could stand with him, providing affirmation and validation for that which protects and fortifies. The beauty of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is it's filled with prophecy, 100% accurate prophecy that proves that God not only exists, but that he authored his testimony. So I will be on the lookout in order to see what he, man that he's going to name here as Shaul, will say about me, observing how he will question me. And that's what Paul's letters do. They question God's ability to do as he promised. So then how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response concerning my disapproving rebuke? God is saying, I don't like this person I'm talking about right now. I really am disgusted by him. Then Yahweh responded to me. He's talking to Habakkuk, which means embrace this. And he said, write this revelation and expound on it using letters upon writing tablets, so that by reciting this, he might run away. Still, surely this revelation from God is for the appointed time of the Moed meetings. Now, Paul, are you aware that God said that in his creation account that the Moed would occur in the fourth generation of human history after leaving the garden, which would be 4000 CE, and that in 33 CE, which is how the year 4000 Yah, that Yahusha, which is the Yahweh's chosen name in the corporal manifestation of his nature, which means Yahweh saves, that he fulfilled the first four of these Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah.
Yeah.
So you're aware of that. Okay. So God is saying, this revelation that I'm giving you right now is specifically for an individual who, that's going to be around at the appointed time of the Moed Mikre, which is 33 CE. So he's now telling you, I'm telling you this 500 years in advance of the time it's going to occur, 600 years. So it's an individual that's going to be around when the Moed Mikre meetings are fulfilled. It provides a witness and it speaks, pouring out evidence at that time. Whatever extended period of time is required for this question to be resolved, this shall not be proven false. Expect him in this regard, because indeed, he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. Pay attention, God says. He will be puffed up with false pride. Boy, if there's any trait, I mean, the number one trait that comes through with Paul is ego, pride. His soul is not right. It's not straightforward in him. So through trust and reliance, by being firmly established and being upheld by that which is dependable and truthful, those who are upright and vindicated will live. Paul actually twisted and misappropriated that line in his letter to the Galatians, which is how I happened to turn to this particular passage. So God is saying, this guy is egotistical. He's not straightforward. He's not right. So if you want my advice, stick to what I've told you, because that's dependable and true. He said, moreover, because the intoxicating wine and the inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal is a high-minded moral failure, and his is an arrogant and meritless presumption. So Paul's salvation through faith, he says his is an arrogant and meritless presumption.
Wow.
He will not rest, he will not find peace, nor will he live. Whoever is open to the broad path, Yosha speaks of the broad path that many lead to their own death and destruction, saying that, in essence, religious and political ways are popular, and that broad path is the one that most follow, and it leads to death and destruction. Well, he was citing this passage in Habakkuk. The broad path is the one associated with the most popular religion in human history. A religion founded and created by Paul. Shaul in his given name. So it's talked about whoever is open to his broad path is going to find no rest, no salvation, and will not live. Then he describes the broad path. He says it's the duplicitous and improper way associated with Shaul. Names him. So let me read that again, because very few people are aware that God specifically spoke of Shaul. He says, moreover, because of the intoxicating wine and the inebriating spirit, Paul admitted to being demon-possessed. I'll read that passage to you if you have a moment after we're done here. Moreover, because of the intoxicating wine and inebriating spirit of a man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal, is a high-minded moral failure, and his is an arrogant and meritless presumption. He will not rest, find peace, or live, whoever is open to the broad path, the duplicitous and improper way associated with Shaul. He and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, receiving him, will never be satisfied. All of the Gentiles, and who was Paul's audience? The Gentiles, right? He called the Gentiles for himself, exclusively for himself. All of the Gentiles will gather together unto him. All of the people from different races, nations, and different places. But they do not ask questions, any of them, about him. What does his name mean? Question him, right? But God says, but they don't ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule. That's the very manner of religion and of Satan. He takes snippets of what God said out of context, misquotes them, and twists it to create the impression that God is endorsing their corruption of his testimony. So they take terse references to the word, and they lift up as taunts to ridicule, with implied associations that mock, controlling through comparison and counterfeit, along with elusive sayings and derisive words arrogantly conveyed. Galatians is the first letter that Paul wrote, and in Galatians, Paul does this very thing. He makes a statement, and then he claims God's authority for that statement by taking something that God said, truncating it, removing it from its context, mistranslating it to convey exactly the opposite of what that message says in context. Those are hard and perplexing. So there are hard and perplexing questions which need to be asked of him. There are double dealings to be known regarding him. So they should say, woe to the one who claims to be great so as to increase his offspring, acting like a rabbi. You know, Paul went to rabbinic school. When neither apply to him, for how long will they make pledges based upon his significance, becoming burdened by his testimony? That's Habacuc. Embrace this. 2:1-6. So God answered that question, didn't he?
Wow. Amazing, eh?
It is amazing. I mean, that's your response was my response. The first time I studied that and translated it from the original Hebrew, I was dumbfounded for probably hours. I just read that and said, everything God said is specifically directed to this this man named Shaul.
Well,
that answered your question.
Through the ages, I mean, look at the all those men of God. I mean, the evangelists. Those awakenings. What do we do with those? I mean, awakenings. You know,
they weren't.
People converted, hoping that you know they found you know peace and life and salvation in Christ Jesus, right?
Yeah, they didn't.
Now.
Yeah, there is no. By the way, there is no Christ. There is no Jesus. There is a Messiah Yahusha, and we will speak specifically to the question that you have just asked, and it explains God's animosity, because the answer to the question is: if they were victimized by Christianity, they ceased to exist. If they promoted Christianity, they're in Sheol. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am Yana. We're here with Paul, who is called in from Ontario, regarding Paul. Paul, your last question by Paul. He's calling in about the man who was born Shaul, which means question him, who changed his name to Paulos, chose a Roman name, a Latin name, and we just considered what God told us about him. And so Paul from Ontario asked the question, well, what is it? What about all of those Christian who went off and preached salvation through faith in a gospel of grace, and the people who believed them? You know, what is their fate, this being so? And Paul, how do I answer that question?
Mm-hmm.
Right there in that statement, he says that moreover, because of the intoxicating wine and the inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal, and he is a high-minded failure, he said, and it's an arrogant and meritless presumption, he will not find rest, he will not find peace, which is reconciliation, nor will he find life. Whoever is open to the broad path, the duplicitous and improper way associated with Sheol, he and his soul are like the plague of death. So God answered that question. If you're, if somebody was a victim, chose to trust Paul's reordering of things, his dismissal of the Torah as being a curse, as being incompetent, as being unable to save, as being something that enslaved, if they bought into that and they chose to believe Paul's gospel of grace and put their faith in it, God has answered the question. They're dead. Their souls cease to exist. I don't know if you know this, Paul, but one of the great misnomers of the Christian religion is that all souls go to either heaven or hell. You know that? I don't know if you know it, but that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Let me explain. So that this will, because it's germane to the question that you asked, and it's embedded in the answer that Yahweh just gave. The vast majority of souls, according to God, do not go to either heaven or hell. They simply cease to exist. at the end of their mortal life. They got to their life. They were given mortal life by God, free will, and a conscience so that they could process information and make an intelligent decision as to what they were going to do with their life. And what God says is the overwhelming preponderance of people who are the victims of religion and political schemes, that they just simply cease to exist. At the end of their life, God doesn't know them. They don't know God. They may have been religious, and therefore they had a relationship with a pretend God. But God doesn't know them. They don't know God. They did not avail themselves of the covenant and its plan of salvation. And so they simply cease to exist. So God says death is the result. So those who trusted and believed in Paul's new religion, their souls don't exist anymore.
Well,
and so it's a minority of souls. There's a place called Sheol. It's written, by the way, identical to Shaul's name. It's Sheol. And Sheol is the place of separation from God.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are an advocate, if somebody is an advocate for Pauline doctrine, if they're a Christian minister, for example, a pope, you know, a leader in the Christian church, and they're promoting Pauline doctrine, they're going to be assumed by God to be in league with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore in league with Satan, the adversary, and they will spend their eternity in Sheol, which is eternal separation from God. Mm-hmm. So that's the minority of people. It's probably 1% of people do spend their eternity separated from God. Those are not the victims of religion. They are the promoters of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And
one
then,
question also. Yeah, excuse me, I interject. It was amazing to me, like, why so many, so little, so few, you know, teach and preach what you're doing? Because, I mean, look at, I met even, you know, those, are you familiar with Messianic Jews?
Mm-hmm.
They are Jewish people,
yes.
You know, converting into, and they speak Hebrew.
Yes.
They read Hebrew scripture,
mm-hmm.
and they don't see that. What you
yeah.
They don't see
yeah,
that.
That's
they combine very smoothly teaching of Paul, combining
mm-hmm.
with the Torah,
correct.
Everything
correct.
Goes well, and
correct.
It amazes me that nobody besides you really, no teaching that. So why
yeah.
so?
Why so few?
So,
yeah, let me answer that question. And by the way, you are extremely astute, Paul. I hope that you not only write me, and you can reach me at any one of the websites by the contact us, or just by Yada at yadayahweh.com. Any one of those, you'll reach me, and I want you to call in again. Messianic Judaism is a blend of Pauline Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism. It takes two wrongs and tries to create a religion out of the two wrongs. Now, we're coming up to a break. This is the longer break. I hope you can stay over for the next segment, because I want to specifically answer the question as to why so few people recognize this and what God said about how many people would come to embrace his covenant and avail themselves of his mercy, because he answered this question for us.
I had tried everything. I'd cut back the amount of food I was eating. I was lifting weights and jogging, but nothing was working. My body was literally starving for minerals and trace elements.